For 100 years, we've been burning fossil fuels to get from point A to point B. Now, when climate change is accelerating, we need other means than the car for individual transportation. Is bicycling part of the solution? Then, how do we build cities that are bike-friendly? This is Medea Vox. I'm Staffan Schmidt, and our guest today is Jason Henderson, professor in geography and environment at San Francisco State University, who is currently focusing on the politics of bicycling. Jason, welcome.
That's right, and thank you for having me this morning. To respond to your sort of big level question, one thing that concerns me with the bicycle movement these days, particularly in San Francisco, where I've been studying for 10 to 15 years, is now the obsession with the electric driverless car. This is a big issue right now that has suddenly, after a decade of talking about bicycles, then this new way of taking the driver out of the responsibility for the car is starting to shape the discourse a little bit.
So what about the meeting between a driverless car and a cyclist?
Exactly. I think that the future of the driverless car in the next 6 months to 1 year, I think we will have a more honest discussion that the driverless car will have to be geofenced. It can only be in an exclusive area where there is no other things to impede it, no humans in the street, no pets in the street, and no other drivers who are the conventional car drivers. So I think we will see very soon that it's not going to work the way it's being envisioned by a lot of the, unfortunately, a lot of sustainability transportation advocates have latched on to this idea of the driverless car.
I think it's kind of, once again, this one-point solution, one-click solution.
Yeah.
The difference here between sort of the street car that once dominated the United States and Europe was actually looking towards the United States, to New York, for instance, for street cars, and had that as a pattern. And this car thing that is run by itself, it's kind of an individualized take on transportation rather than sort of actually physical needs to move from point A to point B.
Yeah.
So it serves like this individual rather. And another thing that I want to talk to you about is we have in our country, and as I can understand you're from San Francisco, there is sort of a growing interest or also an actual push to have more of cyclists on the street, more cyclists on cyclists and cycles on the street. But in Stockholm, for instance, that also is linked to wealth. I would say that people that have wealth, they will invest sort of their lives into this inner cities, which is expensive in Europe, you know, to live in the inner cities.
Yeah.
And to be able to commute on foot or by bike is a sign of wealth.
It's an important issue that you raise, because what's happening is it's not so much, at least in San Francisco and the United States, it's not so much the bicycle, it's that there's a demand to live in the compact city. And it is a market-oriented housing market. And so therefore, the price of living in the center of the city in a more compact development, which the bicycle is practical. And so it's not just a bicycle. I think the bicycle is unfortunately vilified because it is so different. For example, in San Francisco, you can look at where there's very good public transportation that has good, reliable, high-frequency service. We have what's called the Bay Area Rapid Transit System. Anywhere near a station for this system that was built 40 years ago, anywhere near those stations is much more expensive than anywhere else in the Bay Area. And that didn't happen when the system was first built. So we have this trend now of re-urbanizing. And I think it's more complicated than just the wealthy. But for sure, when you don't have an intervention in the housing market, when you don't account for having some policies to keep the housing affordable close to the compact city center, it appears like, well, it's the bicycle and the green infrastructure causes the gentrification. But I think when you start to peel it back.
Yeah, there's an unfortunate connection between sort of the neoliberal city and the cyclist then in that
right.
sense. And
right.
Now we have from Los Angeles when they were doing the subway system there. There was a lot of fights going on there, you know, where to direct it,
mm-hmm.
because everybody understood that, or everybody into economics understood that where you have a station, as you're talking about here,
yeah.
there will be an increase of value.
Yeah, and I understand that this is also, I've been doing a little reading on Malmö. Did I say it correctly?
Sure.
that this is also an issue here, that you have, it's a very broad statement, but that you have sort of three kinds of demographics or kinds of city. You have the creative class, the Western Harbor, which I helped my colleague do the study of, and then the gentrifying core, which is also the creative class. And then you have the inner urban area that has a concentration of more working class and especially immigrants. And then you have the outer suburbs. I'd be curious about the differences in the mobility politics there, because if you were to say that in for example the Bay Area, you know, you get the bicycle in the center, sometimes some say nuanced differences with the immigrant groups, maybe more transit than bicycle, at least in the Bay Area, and then in the outer areas maybe more car. I don't know if that's how it is here, but that's...
Well, you know, if you look at the Copenhagen Index,
mm-hmm.
and one of the points that they're looking at there is to have a bike share system. And Malmö actually have sort of upped its place now from a couple of years back to sixth place, I guess it's now.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at a map of the places where you can get a bike share bike, they are all in the city center.
Mm-hmm.
So actually in the part of the city where people sometimes don't even have the money to have a car, there's no bike sharing system.
Mm-hmm.
So it says something about that,
yeah.
The modal of it. Mm-hmm. Even though we can say for sure that the polluting agents in the air here in the city center, of course, will decrease if there are much more people cycling. But looking at it as from a class perspective or
mm-hmm.
so,
mm-hmm.
And particularly in the immigrant suburbs. But there are other trends there too. I mean, the Swedish Red Cross, they spend a lot of time learning people how to cycle,
mm-hmm.
particularly women.
Mm-hmm.
Live in the suburbs, you know, so they can sort of be more mobile than they've been previously or mm-hmm. in their lives mostly,
yeah,
which is really great. So the cycle actually has an integrating possibility in it, but seen from sort of a perspective of planning goes on for the city center. And then, of course, I mean, commuting and cycling is also different from bike paths along the coastline or
yep.
so and so forth.
Yep.
And we need to focus, I guess, on the commuting part if we're looking for sustainability.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it all kind of points to sort of a much bigger problem, which is that sustainability, a sustainable city, isn't just a technical solution. It has to have a set of policies that talk about housing, that talk about education, that talk about opportunity to not just being a service sector kind of job, like a servant to, you know, to the wealthy, but, you know, opportunity for meaningful work and a meaningful role in society. So maybe by having this conversation, and we're definitely having this conversation in the Bay Area, and I'm picking it up over here in Europe as I've been doing some reading and research. But maybe by having this conversation, we can push this. We know that it's not just fixing the transportation system, because when you do that, if it's a complete unregulated housing market, then it does benefit the wealthy or those who can afford to move into the center. So we've got to address housing. Basically.
And that's part of what you're doing, actually, or that's part of your department, I guess, also.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course. I mean, but then again, when it comes to planning, of course, there is a in the American tradition, there's of course this vast difference between Jane Jacobs and Robert Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of, and you said that San Francisco was didn't have all of that freeway system.
Well, the Bay Area has a huge freeway system, but the city in the late 1950s, the city stopped the construction of a network of expressways through the center of the city. But some of them were built because they had been approved previously. Actually, what's interesting also to stay with this sort of justice and equity issue is that when you do look closely at the politics in San Francisco in the late 1950s opposing the freeways, when the freeways were built through the poor neighborhoods, there wasn't very much opposition or protest. It wasn't only when they had to link them up and they had to go through wealthier, more middle class and white neighborhoods in San Francisco, then you had this political outcry against the freeway. So I'm not trying to downplay the importance of the freeway revolt. It was a very, very important watershed moment in American history. But to truly understand the urban politics and the social forces at work, at that time in the late 50s and early 60s, the lower income sections of San Francisco and the African American part, for example, was overlooked, and the freeways were built. That said, there was because of the opposition from the more white middle class that kind of made a strong argument against the freeways, the civil rights movement also rallied around opposing the freeways. And so then in the second phase of the freeway revolt, there was more of a coalition, which was an interesting coalition because it was a sort of a conservative homeowner coalition and a leftist housing rights and social justice coalition coalescing over this particular issue about the how to develop the city. But maybe once that's finished, not agreeing on other issues. So it's
it reminds me of Henri Lefebvre, in fact, when he says that there are always some questions that transgress these kind of differences between classes, and that would be spatial issues.
Yeah.
So if someone is sort of threatening your space or the integrity of your space, then you can sort of rally over different groups or create connections between different groups, which is absolutely great. And how do we do this today?
Yeah, I think, we have these movements that rise and fall or rise and go to sleep in the U.S. Right now I'm thinking about young people who are dissatisfied with neoliberalism and how it's affecting the U.S. And so, for example,
And the world, right.
And how they supported Senator Sanders against Clinton in the primary. The big question is, who is going to take that energy and that movement? Because those are the same people, even though it wasn't a campaign issue, those are the same people. That politics is the politics of the compact sustainable city. That's the core constituency of bicycling. That's the core constituency of better social housing policies, better public transportation. That's the constituency that cares the most, not that other people don't care, but the most about climate change and the impact it's having, not just on making the world a hotter place, but on the equity issues, the movement of people because of climate change in other parts of the world, and seeing a sense of injustice in that. So how to tap into that energy, to that movement? If I had an answer, I don't know, maybe I would be in Congress, but it's like these things come and then how do you steer it? But I do think that when these big national movements in the US happen and then settle down a little bit, they do stay alive in cities and people do kind of localize. And so, even now in San Francisco, while the big Trump Hillary Clinton election is happening, we do have city council elections and other very important elections that are about the livability of the city and who decides
so
the
sort
future.
Of sort of the local politics the community politics mm-hmm. or whatever you can call it. And I mean, you see the farmers markets as for an example, you know, there's definitely a discussion going on about huge food corporations and all the transportation that is involved in all of that. And there's, when looking at sustainability, of course, there's the question of what we eat, meat, for instance, how much of the agriculture sector that actually contributes to the climate change even more, and so actually in comparison to cars.
Yeah,
it kind of levels out, but still, and of course there's the equity question about the rainforests and Amazonas and all of that. So maybe could we look at cycling as a metaphor for a change, or I mean, we're now discussing it from, you know, it's always making, there's parts and parcels of everything, but maybe to have this as a metaphor of some kind.
I think the bicycle is going to be one of the most important tools of fighting climate change, because it will provide people with access, with liberty, with connection to their community too, because you have a different sense in the community. I definitely want to point out that as a cyclist in the US, we are very isolated. Even though you do sense your community, it's single file. You're often with traffic. And when I come to a place like Malmo or Copenhagen or the Netherlands, where you can ride side by side and where it's not as fast, I think that I don't know if it's a metaphor, but the connectivity humanizes. It helps humanize the city in the space of the city. And to me, it's also about a bigger issue that, you know, the social change that we need is to slow down in everything, in our diet, in our expectation of the food to come to us, in our expectation to be able to cross the city within a short amount of time. That's a cultural change. And when I'm thinking about mobility, I'm looking at all the different positions, but there's definitely a subgroup that does talk about slowing down. And the problem with slowing down is that you challenge the economic order, because the economic order is to go fast. Faster is money. This is in a sort of philosophical way or metaphoric way as well. The bicycle is a slowing down. And it's a challenge of how, you know, using the city, not just for economic efficiency, but for life. I don't know if that's what
you... Well, definitely. I mean, what I'm thinking, because we inherited a system with the structure of the roads and sort of the car industry and all of that, and the fossil fuel systems that dates back to the 19th century, I guess. I was thinking about the one geographer here in Lund, the neighboring city, Torsten Hegerstrand, who wrote about time geography.
Oh, yeah. Time-space.
Yeah, yeah. Time-space relation. And that was picked up, I guess, in the 60s in the meaning, or caught the meaning of or having sort of been interpreted as the farther you can reach during a day, the more freedom you have. So the more locations that you can actually access. So the speed was there really, really important to sort of talk about freedom. And of course, I guess that's a generation where they were sort of had the feeling of being locked in. I mean, even a prior Swedish prime minister were talking about the freedom that the car gave his family. Because they were sort of landlocked, and they couldn't move anywhere, and then they got this car and they can go for vacations or whatever. So how to sort of, that's where the metaphor also enters here, because we need to sort of fill this with some kind of meaning. And I think it's really important what you're saying here, that to humanize the city, and the cars actually put people in so to speak tin cans. Yeah. And there is no sort of sensory outer side to that.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about what's happening here in Malmo, because I've done some reading, and I'm familiar with the Western Harbor, and you do have a very impressive mode share for bicycling relative to many other cities. But what's happening?
Yeah, the figures. I mean, there are different grounds for this. I mean, maybe it started in to make the bike paths better and to look after the bike paths. I mean, we have winter here, or yeah. At least we used to have winter.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. That was actually a really important shift that the city decided to, when it's been a snowfall or even like frozen rain, mm-hmm. that you look to the bike paths before you go for the roads.
Okay.
Because, you know, I mean, cars are four-wheeled mostly, mm-hmm. and there's actually a law that you need to have certain tires on when it's cold, mm-hmm. and slippery. Mm-hmm. But so they actually were looking after cyclists. And mm-hmm. there were statistics behind that, of mm-hmm. course.
To keep cyclists from stopping, not revisiting cycling in the spring, they start to drive.
That's one part of the statistic. Mm-hmm. The other part of the statistics was, of course, the hospitals and sort of the emergency rooms, mm-hmm. because in the winter you have a lot of people that would hurt mm-hmm. themselves cycling, and that would sort of encourage people from using the cycle. So this was actually trying to say, okay, we can commute. That's why commuting is important when it comes mm-hmm. to cycling. Commute year round. I would say that was a really important shift. Mm-hmm. And then that the figures are pointing in the right direction. We are currently, I guess, something just a percent or so below 30%.
For all the cycling? For all trips?
Yeah,
all trips. That's impressive. You're approaching Copenhagen.
Yeah, we are actually mm-hmm. doing that. I mean, the figures are a bit shaky, but I think we're getting there. I mean, there was a set goal a couple of years ago that we would reach 30%, mm-hmm. but I think we're already mm-hmm. touching on that. Mm-hmm. And there's been changes in the law system that make it possible to establish bike passages that you can cross over a street, and the cars really have to stop.
I think I just came in on one of those, and I thought it was pretty nice.
Yeah, and you know, street lights for mm-hmm. particularly for cyclists. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, you say you can travel in parallel or cycle in parallel in your city. I mean, it's still a sort of a fight that goes on about who has the right to claim space.
Yeah.
And I think that's a universal claim. I mean, the city center of San Francisco, as well as this city, was built before the car.
The thing that is a little fascinating to me in this debate about space, too, is that the vast majority of the people in the car are one person, and yet the vehicle is 2 or 3 meters wide. And how many meters long? Like four or five? And yet there's this contention and hostility about the space. And I don't know, I don't get the sense that it's as strong here. And I've been in Copenhagen mostly, but in the U.S. it's definitely an issue that people say, well, you have to get out of the way. And that takes me back to the slowing down idea, but also the spatial consumption idea. And I find that those images that you see from time to time on some blog or the internet, where they show the space of the passengers on the bus, the space of the bicycle, and the space of the car.
Yeah, it's a Dutch experiment.
It's just amazing.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
That you show people that and they get it. When I show my classes that, they get it. And I have to say, most of my students, they're from California, they drive. But when they get out of my class, at least some of them are thinking, well, maybe I shouldn't be able to just park by the door of my building, or maybe I should, you know, try different modes of transportation. So, but those visuals and getting people to really understand the space. Do you think that Malmo is going to go much further with the bicycle mode share, or is it going to stay at about 25 or 30%?
No, I mean, there are, I mean, it depends actually a lot on politics.
Yeah.
What kind of politics will we see in the future here? I know that you've been talking about brown fields and gray fields, mm-hmm. yeah? And so gray fields, parking lots and this mm-hmm. kind of things and low density things. And we don't have really that spread out character of our cities in Europe, mostly not, mm-hmm. like in comparison to the U.S. But gray, I mean, the parking lot and the area, parking areas in the city, I think that is now becoming sort of publicly seen less attractive. And that is a change of the polity. And of course, there's politics involved and policy making involved in that. But the polity, the people are actually looking at parking space as, why do we really need that? Mm-hmm. Or we have to tuck away the cars underground somewhere. But in Malmö, you know, you need water almost direct, like in Copenhagen.
Right.
So there's not much to
dig. It becomes expensive. You have to pump it out.
Yeah, that becomes really expensive. Yeah. And I actually had a campaign here with my students about the garage under this building.
Yeah.
And I tried to sort of talk to my students, saying that why is there so many cars here? I mean, we're supposed to be this university that works towards sustainability.
The railway station's just right there.
It's just a few meters away. You know,
the buses all come.
And you know, and it caused a lot of interesting situation, because I started to talk to people jumping out of their cars, and I'm, why are you driving your car here? And they were like, what? Mm-hmm. Are you talking to me? Mm-hmm. Kind of thing. And it was really interesting to have their sort of answers. And some of them were actually saying that, I'm sorry, I have a bicycle, mm-hmm. but not this morning, you know? Yeah. Others were more like, I live where I live, mm-hmm. I have dogs, and mm-hmm. I have kids, and I need a huge truck.
Are those other professors?
Well, let's not go into that.
We have that issue at SF State.
Right. Yeah. So of course, I mean, the garage under this building is actually an image and mirror of, at least of that part.
This building is a brand new building, right?
Sure.
It's like 2 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
And politics, you know, they're involved in sort of saying that you, I could see that also, that you've been writing about it, that you can sort of disconnect or disbundle the relation between an apartment and parking lot. Mm-hmm. And that's been contentious here, yeah. I guess, even in this country.
Yeah.
Because there are laws and regulations saying that if there is a building, there need to be parking lots.
Yeah.
And the distance between building and parking lot has to be this and that.
It adds a lot of cost to the construction of the building and the operation of the building, and it's an opportunity cost, because it means you can't do something else with that space, which you might, for example, you might have families in apartment buildings that, as the families grow, what about just using the space at the basement for storage for their belongings, rather than having the car? So there's all kinds of things. The parking issue is something that I decided that I'm going to talk about that this afternoon, because in looking at the Western Harbor, I know there was a lot of debate about how much parking there should be and would people come without their cars. This is also a huge issue in San Francisco. And I guess what I was getting at about, where do you see Malmo going? In San Francisco, we had a good 10 years of successful political change to reform our parking in much of the city, not all of the city, but particularly in the areas where there's future development, like your Western Harbor. We have a lot of these areas of new buildings that can be 80 feet, 100 feet high, kind of like the compact city of Malmo. They can be built without parking, but also they cannot build as much parking as they used to have to build. So we've got lower caps and zero. You can choose to not have it. And more some developers are choosing it, but the expression is, we're resting on our laurels. There's no appetite right now to take that another step. I think there will be soon, but it's sort of like these things happen in stages. It's the same with the bicycle. We did the easy stuff. It was easy to put in bike lanes on low traffic streets, or streets that were built way too wide. They thought there were going to be more cars. But actually, where you want the bicycles to go, which is where all the cars go to, and especially in San Francisco, because it's a hilly city, you want to be on the most level routes. Those are the hard parts where politicians go, well, I love bikes, but that's not where they go. With the parking, it was easy to rethink new buildings. There were no residents. There were industrial areas, and so on. So there wasn't. But now what we really need to do is, the solution to San Francisco's housing, a solution to San Francisco's housing problem, is underneath each house. There's as much room as a living space for cars. We could create economic incentives and policies that get people to reintroduce the housing underneath their house. And these apartment buildings, they have lots of space underneath. And we just need to use our imagination and also provide a little bit of subsidy and help. But an interesting opportunity in San Francisco on that note is that because of earthquakes, we do need to fix our buildings. So you could, if you had the right political leadership, connect the two. Say, the state will help you fix your building so that it won't fall, but you have to get rid of the parking. That's a policy idea. Right now, the state is trying to help people fix their buildings, but not requiring them to do something in return.
Sounds like a good trade-off, but I'm sitting here wondering what if the city also provides for public transport. I mean, that would be nice to have this connection.
We have a major problem. We have political support for public transportation at the city level. Everyone loves public transportation. Everyone loves bikes. When it comes to the street, we just had a big fight in San Francisco over making one bus, a very important bus that is mostly low-income passengers, to give it its own lane, its own passageway through the city. And the merchants went crazy. The merchants on that corridor said that it was going to take away their business, ruin their, because of the park, because they had to take away some of the parking, not all of the parking. The city, I think, did a very good job of bending over backwards to try to accommodate these people. This was in the Mission District, but unfortunately, even doing that, there was just this opposition. So what we have is a weaker, less optimal solution for the bus. The problem is everybody says they love the public transportation and they want to fund it and they support it. They run on for office, but when it comes to the specifics, whether it's a bike lane or a street, and interestingly enough, this is what I'm learning about Copenhagen as well, that every politician supports the bicycle policy.
Well,
it
becomes an accessoire for the city in a way, you know. It's like a scarf or something. Mm-hmm. The suit is still the same. This is car suit. Mm-hmm. The city is clad in that. But mm-hmm. That's one of the things I wonder also about, the sort of how serious politicians are, really.
Yeah.
And how deep they can look into this when it comes to sustainability. And if they can sort of use the metaphor of the cycle in positive ways for not only for the personal political careers, but also to sort of make City Hall listen to this sound, I mean, the sanity of the whole thing. Yeah?
I mean, I think there's the solutions are very local, but then there's these national and international trends. And I think that we're in this phase right now where oil has become so cheap again, but it will not always be that way. And if you look at the time when oil becomes expensive, you do get more political change. And that political change lasts for a few years, but the infrastructure is lasting. So for example, many of the European cities in the 1970s responded to the energy crisis with investment in transit and bicycle infrastructure. Then the crisis went away, but the infrastructure was still there. And so you had this momentum to continue to do it, even with out in the suburbs or other parts of the countries, maybe people buy more cars. But you have the sort of in place. And so the way I kind of think about it is the next wave, which is coming, we just need to really go, we just need to get more space in the city. I think every city in the world almost has a plan. It's just ready to go, and it would bring dramatic change. So I'm optimistic in that history tells us that there will be, the price of oil especially is going to go up, and the electric car and the driverless car, I think we like to talk about it, but I think in a few years it's going to be apparent that it's going to be for the rich.
I look right at that as another kind of car industry, yes. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to, once again, this one-click solution, that if you look at the car industry, the cost of production in terms of sustainability, negative effects on sustainability for a car, doesn't make that much difference if you keep on running your fossil fuel car. Mm-hmm. Then you buy a new one, which has been newly produced and transported from all parts of the world. and all of equity for questions doesn't sort of disappear now with the lithium for the batteries. This is really bad.
The issue of the displaced emissions. I mean, San Francisco, we say, we have such a clean environment, high quality of life. That's why the tech companies ironically want to be in the Bay Area. There's some environmental factors, like we've got good wind from the Pacific Ocean that takes our pollution into the center of California. But everything that those tech companies manufactures is in China. And that's where the emissions are. And I think while I'm supportive of the incremental push to have a better climate deal at Paris, I think a more globally equitable climate change policy would address this issue of displaced emissions, and it would actually force us to really rethink the car. Because if you think about this, America has 800 cars for every 1,000 people. Malmo, I was looking at it yesterday, is 450 or 80, something like that, which is the kind of middle to high end of European cities. America's 800. Beijing is less than 100. And what do we read in the newspaper? How horrible the pollution and traffic is in Beijing. But it is less than 10% of households driving in that city. Now, there's taxis and things too, and there's the coal-fired power plants. But we're displacing the emissions, in the U.S. at least, to Asia and Mexico and India, and demanding that they stop where they are. This is a question that I ask people all the time, whether it's in my class or at the beginning of a talk or anywhere, is what kind of world do we have if China replicates the U.S. and has 800 cars? It doesn't matter if they're electric.
No, we definitely, and that's the question that we cannot really, we see it looming actually, and it's really, really overwhelmingly important to deal with a new kind of economics overall here. In Sweden, we have been boasting for some time that we've been so ecologically aware and mm-hmm. sort of looking forward. All the planning system, etc., and sort of then we started to talk about consumption. That we're really, our economy is strong, means that a lot of people buy a lot of stuff that it possibly won't need that much. And also that I think Sweden is number two when it comes to emissions, per capita emissions when it comes to flying.
Right.
In the world.
Right. Yeah, that's...
Yeah. Yeah. And that's another one. And then, you know, from let's say, in 20 years back in time, or even closer in time, maybe the last 10 years, you can see the increase. Now we're getting back to the food, to meat, consumption mm-hmm. of meat, just skyrocketed.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of awareness, I would say. So it doesn't really have to be this way, but still the structure, the system is so strong at this point. Mm-hmm. It's hard to sort of evade a disaster here.
Yeah. So is there a conversation in Sweden about the future of energy production in Sweden? Because I know that there's a hydroelectric system, but, you know, for example, in California, we also have hydroelectric, but actually...
You're running out of water.
We're running out of water. Well, we have water.
Snowfall.
We're running out of snowpack.
Yeah.
And the hydroelectric, I think we were on average about 15% or so of our electricity is hydroelectric. It was 7% because of the
lack of
4-year drought.
The Sierras.
And so is this an issue, kind of an issue here where you did have this investment, but...
I think we're pretty good at looking... towards a pretty good, we have the nuclear power plants,
uh-huh.
yeah, and there are some political discussions going around
about building
whether,
new ones, or
there's the neoliberal thing comes in as a positive factor, because they say, do you have to pay, if there's going to be a new power plant, you have
expensive.
To pay, for everything,
yeah,
and including insurances,
yeah,
that stops most of them in their tracks, but then again, wind,
yeah,
there's a lot of that here, as you've maybe you sense
saw
today.
When I came over the train,
And water power plant are, of course, still a huge part of the Swedish mm-hmm. electricity.
But is there room to expand hydroelectricity?
There,
is
there,
that a
there
good
will
idea?
Be fighting, of course, because they're natural. When this system were sort of conceived and they built all of the dams. We were looking at in industrialist Sweden after Second World War, sort of expansionist and positive, and so environmental questions as far off, it's up in the north. Yeah. Today, it's not, that wouldn't happen today.
Yeah, but this is the question, right? If you switch to electric cars, the hydroelectric system and the wind system might be very good things, but aren't they already claimed for the housing and also for the electric trains? So if you create a whole new system of demand for the green energy, is it actually possible? And, you know, you're going to have people say, well, we'll have special batteries and all this stuff. But even then, there's energy involved in that.
There are lithium in them and they're toxic. So yeah. That's not really a solution.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I like Bill McKibben a lot.
So, okay.
Yeah. So, in The End of Nature, and he talks about, I think it's there, he talks about sort of a localized energy systems as well. So he said, I don't need a battery in my basement. I need a place to which my utility grid is connected, so where the wind blows.
Yeah.
If it's calm here,
yeah,
you know, so he foresaw sort of a very distributed sort of electrical grid, and also like an internet of electricity, some kind of thing, yeah. But then again, we have to imagine ourselves in a completely different outtake of energy.
Yeah,
I mean, a much lower level.
Yeah, and he's in Vermont, which is 800,000 people, beautiful countryside.
Burlington is beautiful. And Middlebury is even more beautiful, actually. So, yeah, he's out there.
But what do you do with the, you know, how do you do that with the city, a city of like Berlin or London or, you know?
We don't know. I mean, the roofs, of course, would be used, I guess.
But I think this goes back to the bicycle. Yes, you have to manufacture a bicycle, and yes, there's some petroleum and some plastics and things like this, but in the end, it is so much more optimal. And it'll help us to slow down, but also reduce our consumption. And that consumption maybe needs to go somewhere else to make a better train system so you don't have to fly as much or don't choose to fly as much, or a better energy system, you know, to do the connectivity. So, again, I mean, I think the bicycle touches all these things in a way that isn't just about having a nice, shiny bike and looking good and being hip, you know.
It could be that too. I tend to say that every kind of cycling is good.
Yeah.
So if I've surpassed by a racer, you know, I'm hard to accept that I've been surpassed by it. But you know, anyway, I like it.
Mm-hmm.
And so all kinds of that will bring sort of people into my sort of field of vision, and also that the closeness of when you stop in the morning. And by red cycling light, there's this bunch of people that are gasping for air. Some of them and some of them are like red faced, and it's a really nice situation.
Mm-hmm.
And there are small chats, and also that there is a sort of a trust and a feeling between cyclists in relation then again to the cars.
Yeah.
So you could see a situation in front of you. Someone is, you know, almost, you know, touched by a car, and then you can cycle up to this individual and you talk to them and say, you know, I saw this. I know you were in your right. There's also a positive sense of community among cyclists. Not everywhere and not all the time, but there is something more of that. You can actually talk to people.
Yeah, and it's this kind of joy. And being alive and being in the city, being part of people or being in nature, that I think is, you know, I don't think you really experience it until you try it. So I would encourage, if anybody's listening, the joy of bicycling is an incredible
feeling. And year round.
Yeah. I'm going to do it tomorrow. I'm going to take tours of Malmo, learn about the city by bike. And I don't care if it's raining or.
I mean, and the figures, are clear that more and more people will live in cities, in huge cities. So we need to do something about it. We cannot sort of continue the way that we've done with transportation.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So I guess we're at the end of this conversation. So, Jason, thank you very much for coming here and talking to us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure, and I'm very inspired by this what I'm seeing in Malmo. So I look forward to learning more.
Happy to hear that.